Thank you very much for inviting me to speak here, for inviting us. Actually, this is a double lecture with Mark Wigley, and I would like to start by expanding the traditional understanding of the Bauhaus to include the full kaleidoscope of its obsessions, from the depth of the unconscious to outer space. The Bauhaus, in fact, was never... the Bauhaus, in fact, was never straightforward. It was never straight at all, as you will see. Despite the surface rhetoric of rationality, clarity, efficiency, smooth surfaces, etc., Bauhauslers were engaged with everything that escaped rationality, sexuality, violence, exoteric philosophies, occultism, disease, the psyche, pharmacology, extraterrestrial life, artificial intelligence, chance, the primitive, the fetish, the animal, plants, etc. So in that sense, you can say that the Bauhaus was a veritable cauldron of perversions. Our main point is that the Bauhaus was actually performance work, staged in a variety of media to great effect. An extreme performance, if you want, that went viral and is still playing in the latest media, particularly in social media. It is not by chance that a performance stage was precisely at the heart of the Bauhaus building and at the heart of every publication. The whole thing, you could argue, from the stage to the buildings, the graphics, the products, the books, the films, was a form of theater. Our brief remarks here today are based actually on a collaborative research project that we conducted with our students and at Princeton University and at Columbia University. And we explore two interrelated themes, the extreme, even cultish attitudes and behaviors that energize this performance, this is what I will do here, and the active and sophisticated construction and global projection of a self-image of the Bauhaus through a range of different media. This is what Mark will do after me. The hypothesis is precisely that a crucial part of the shocking success of this ongoing performance was a set of experimental attitudes about sexuality, diet, breathing, animals, plants, etc. And this is the side of the Bauhaus that is normally repressed, but I think it's absolutely central to the success. In our view, the Bauhaus project to construct a new man, actively redesigning the human, has to be understood in terms of a deeper psychosexual and psychotechnological obsession that underpin every aspect of the Bauhaus. The idea of constructing a new kind of normalized superhuman was not just a response to the trauma of war, whose shadow was always there at the Bauhaus, but was also driven by an experimentation with alternative understandings of the human body and brain. Well, basically, we are arguing that the Bauhaus was a kind of opera in that sense, a formidable, dramatic performance work involving radical understandings of the humans that needs to be understood before it can be overcome with another kind of counter-performance. It is important to remember that Gropius imagined that the culmination of the Bauhaus, as has been just said by Marion, will be architecture as a synthesis of the art, technology, and experience. And architecture actually is almost always understood as having a normalizing function, establishing patterns that are stable, predictable, and to some extent standardized. The right angle is called the normal and is very hard to find in nature. I think I put a slide in the wrong place. Here it is. Gropius. The right angle, in that sense, belongs to architecture, to culture. The idea of architecture is intimately associated with the idea of the normal. Perhaps it sees itself, architecture, as the caretaker of the normal. But the normal, of course, is not normal. It's a kind of artifact, always produced, never found. It is a construction involving a certain violence. Meanwhile, there is a hidden tradition in architecture of the transgressive, word that crosses the lines of the normal, complicating these lines, threatening the limit. As Michel Foucault wrote in the preface to Transgression of 1963, originally an homage to Georges Bataille, the limit and transgression depend on each other for whatever density of being they possess. A limit could not exist if it were absolutely uncrossable, and reciprocally, transgression would be pointless if it merely crossed a limit composed of illusions and shadows. Transgression, then, is not a small, eccentric, austere chapter in architecture, but a constant presence even in the work of the most orthodox or most conservative thinkers and designers of the 20th century, even if we as historians of architecture try very hard to repress this. Take Le Corbusier, for example, the single most influential architect of the 20th century. He was deeply into the occult, into exoteric philosophies, sexual complexity. He was a cross-dresser. Here he is dressed as an odalisk in Turkey. Eschatological, obsessed with the toilets, with sexual complexities. Here we have him as a cleaning lady, eschatological, obsessed with the toilet, all these drawings with the bidet that he put in the middle of the living space to his the distress of his wife that used to put a little tea cosy on top of it when there were visitors. Very interested in, of course, nudismo, bodybuilding, the animal. Here is with his dog, and when his dog died, he actually covered his Don Quixote with the skin of his dog. All kinds of perversities, and of course obsessed with the other, etc. And there are, of course, in the history of architecture, less known figures like Carlo Mollino, where architecture and design for him are literally the product of perversion, so much so that he's not easily placed in any traditional account of modern architecture. This is some of his work as a photographer, but also as a dress designer, etc., and all these things that you know. I mean, he was also a race car in Le Mans. He wins a crazy skier, and I don't know exactly what he's doing here, but you get the sense. So historians actually, because of this, don't know how to position him. So you have two extremes then. Le Corbusier, a seemingly straight architect who is secretly twisted, and then Mollino, which is a seemingly twisted architect, but in fact is secretly at the center of modern architecture. The question then becomes whether so-called perversions are twists of modern architecture or they are its very engine. Perversion, in fact, comes from the Latin pervertere, to turn away, that is, to turn away from normality. And there is a relationship with the personal, often pathologies of modern architecture, and their call for a new normal, a tension between which a new concept of the human emerged. But design perversions are not simply about the all-too-human pathologies of designers. It is about the construction, precisely, of the human by modern design. A catalogue of modern architecture is actually like a catalogue of perversions. Let me quickly go through the 20th century. I point to a few cases in which, in the spirit of everything you always wanted to know about architecture but were afraid to ask, I will reveal to you the ways in which modern architecture is full of secrets. So let's start with Adolf Loos, the great moralist, ornament and crime. But when Loos arrived in Paris in 1926, he was actually on the run, accused of pederastia in Vienna, of pedophilia, where he was found with a young child and convicted, a fact that until recently was carefully concealed in all the scholarships on Loos, despite that it's public, that there's all these trials and things. But the great moralist of ornament and crime turns out to be a criminal himself. His succession of teenage brides, here you have a few of them, and there are many more, were to be brought in this fiery bedroom. Let's move to Richard Neutra, another Austrian, another Viennese, whose theories of architecture are very influenced by theories about diet, exercise, nudismo. When he gets to California, he published in this Nude Living, this article about the complex of nudismo, diet, etc. But she also thought that architecture could enhance the sex life of the inhabitants. He was very influenced by psychoanalysis, etc. Many clients of Neutra talked to him about his their nervous problems, their marital problems, their fertility problems, and he installed in their houses Wilhelm Reich's orgon accumulators. Perhaps you don't know what our orgon accumulator is, but it was popularized as the orgasm machine in films like Barbarella or Woody Allen Sleeper. So not only he installed these orgon machines in the houses of his clients, but he ends up arguing that the houses that he's designing himself are like orgon accumulators, kind of sex machines. Okay. another Viennese, and it's starting to look like it's all Viennese, but it's not, you will see. Bernard Rudowski, which is completely into foot fetishism, but here he develops a complete catalog of abnormal bodies that are lurking between normal clothing, like this tennis outfit from the 19th century, and argue that the literal torture of binding the feet of young Chinese girls was actually acted out in the streets in the West regularly. He shows that the foot that compresses, that corresponds to a stylish shoe, is the form as in a Chinese lily foot. Likewise, he shows that the perverted, so it's not just the foot of the women, but also of the men, because he shows this feet of the Western men, and he says if we keep going that way with this kind of Oxford shoe, we'll end up developing a big toe in the middle. Rudowski ends up designing a kind of counter fashion, these kind of sandals that are still sold, Rudowski sandals, clothes that supposedly liberate the body like these sandals. And yet he clearly enjoys, as you could see in the images, the pornography of this deformed body with a particular obsession on the feet. His fetish is equally intense with the twisted foot as is with the supposedly liberated one that you see here. Okay, this is crazy because the next one is another Viennese. I didn't realize that. Kiesler, Frederick Kiesler, and eating disorders. Who would have thought that architecture had anything to do with eating disorders? But that's what actually Kiesler is telling us, that architecture is a digestive system, that the house is like a stomach full of holes absorbing juices and nutrients, and that the occupant becomes a kind of food in extraordinary confusion of his own body. With architecture, he projects his own eating disorders onto the house, and he describes modern architecture as an architecture on a diet. But the time of the diet is now finished, and now we are in danger, apparently, of being overweight, and points to buildings like the Guggenheim of Manhattan as having a problem of overweight architecture. So projecting his own eating complications, he starts for most of his life into his architecture. Okay, this is American Bucky Fuller, finally, was obsessed with the toilet, seeing it as the center of everyday life and the beginning of thought. He spent years designing the perfect toilet and photographed himself naked inside it for architectural and women's magazines. He detested the idea that anything coming out of the body will leave the house, arguing that valuable chemicals are to be recycled from the house. Not such a stupid idea after all. And of course, I could go on and on and on with all these modern architects, but don't think for a minute that it's just modern architecture. Even in more contemporary times, you have things like this, bondage. In the 1970s, Bernard Tschumi, not only he wrote a series of essays on the relations between architecture and transgression, deeply influenced by Bataille, but he explored also the erotics and economy of forbidden acts, such as bondage or crime, and this culminated in a series of advertisements for architecture in 1976, like the one that you have on the screen. Bodybuilding and porn will be Rem Koolhaas, who with OMA took Miss Barcelona Pavilion and twisted it for the Milano Triennale to produce the bodybuilding house, where the neoclassic Kolbe sculpture in the pavilion was replaced by the naked body of Lisa Lyon, the first woman bodybuilder, champion bodybuilder in California, photographed by Robert Matterhorn. The supposed calming space of Miss was turned into an erotics of exercise, complete with these secret pictures that I found in the archives of the Koolhaas office. Koolhaas, who wrote a script for a porno film, The White Slave, before becoming an architecture, turns architecture into a movie set for an expanding, eroticized body. If there is no such a thing, then, as modern architecture without transgression, as I have tried to demonstrate here in 3 minutes, what is remarkable about the Bauhaus, and perhaps the secret of its success, is the sheer density of transgressions of every kind. It was like a laboratory for inventing and intensifying perversions as a kind of pedagogical strategy. Perhaps we could argue there is no education without transgression and even without perversions. But this fact is typically repressed in the name of discipline, tradition, expertise, responsibility, etc. The Bauhaus both embraced transgression and repressed it. So here is another very quick catalogue of the perversions of the Bauhaus. Purim, Johannes Itam, in his preparatory course at the Bauhaus, introduced, as you probably know, a regime of purging following the principle of the Mahatanan religion. The idea was to get to rid the body of the gross matter through enemas, fasting for 3 weeks, or a diet of garlic-based mass, and machines actually for picking up the skin. Here you have some drawings of Paul Citroën, who not only did these drawings illustrating the situation, but also writes about this machine. There was, among other things, a little needle machine with which we were to puncture our skins. Then the body will be rubbed with the same sharp oil which can serve as a laxative. A few days later, all the pinpoints will break out in scabs and pustules. The oil had drawn the waste and impurities of the deeper skin layers to the surface. Now we were ready to be bandaged, but we must work hard, sweat, and then with continued fasting, the ulceration will dry out. But of course, they didn't dry out, they festered for weeks, and this is part of the masochism of the Bauhaus. Okay, occultism. One of the intended effects of item regime was a trance-like delirium after 3 weeks of fasting, no surprise, offering access to a spiritual domain reinforced by deep breathing and concentration exercises run by Gertrude Grunow that she brought to the Bauhaus to teach these classes, and that will take over sometimes the whole class. Many of the masters, like Klee and Kandinsky, were into different forms of occultism and spirituality. Exoteric logic was not exoteric within the school. It was a kind of science. There was a genre of spirit photography. A Bauhaus object, like this Breuer slat chair, was suspended in with this ghost in the chair, or Paul Citroën here in a spiritist seance in 1924. Okay. Very quickly, gender ambiguities. Here you have Margareta Hyman. There was continuous experimentation with the performance of gender at the Bauhaus. Gender inversion was the norm. Famously, women perform as men, and less famously, men cross-dress and put lipstick on and ties on in many of these situations. Here you have one of these parties. Several of these men are dressed as women or have lipstick or have ties or are cross-dressing. Perhaps most interesting, Martha Browes sent a tantalizing card to Walter Gropius for his 41st birthday party, including a double image of himself as Martha Breuer as a woman, and with the words, "My dear Walter, keep our sweet secret eternally and truly yours, Martha Breuer." Hair. The Bauhaus is unthinkable without the haircuts, which were used to embrace gender ambiguity and express modernity. The Bauhaus student had to look like a Bauhaus student, which meant visualizing transgression. You can do actually a catalog, as one of our students, John Cooper at Princeton, did, of all the haircuts and their evolution at the Bauhaus, including completely shaving your head, as Ethan urged his followers. And Lothar Schroeder reminds us, when one day Eaton declared that hair was a sign of sin, his most enthusiastic disciples shaved their head completely, and thus we went around Weimar. Okay, leather. The leather, of course, of the Luftwaffe jacket used by fighter pilots, and also the leather used in bondage and in SM and lesbian clubs around here in Berlin, made its way into the Bauhaus as a symbol of cultural rebellion and sensuality. It clothes both male and female. Here you have Marianne Brandt. Gropius also went around, apparently, in the memories of Herbert Bayer with a leather jacket. The chairs were bound, not only made in leather, but were bound tightly like corsets. And leather straps and whips are lying around inexplicably sometimes in photographs, suggesting some kind of illicit act. Initiation Fantasies. I was told, says Herbert Boyer, that during the entrance examination, every applicant is locked up in a dark room. Thunder and lightning are let loose upon him to get him in a state of agitation. His being admitted depends on how well he describes his reaction. So there is all these initiation rituals. And with this, we move to physical assertion. Under the excuse of gymnastics or trying to gain control of the unruly body, any opportunity to put the body in extreme position was taken. A sport in the Bauhaus was training the body for artistic work, but also to cure neurosis, neurosis from the war, but also collective neurosis. It actually, interesting enough, had been a successful competitive gymnast before he came to the Bauhaus. He used to play soccer, track, and field. He integrated the sport in his prep course as a means of physical control to release the mime. After Eden left, the whole thing continued. The flat roof of the student housing at Dessau was designed for exercise, and Hannes Meyer reintroduced physical education to combat what he called the proverbial collective neurosis of the Bauhaus, the result of the one-sided emphasis on brain work. Even during the parties, apparently the Bauhausler had developed their signature dance moves involving exaggerated rhythmic movements. Eroticism. For all the official commitment to artistic experimentation on the way towards sober industrial design, there is a continuous erotic charge in many aspects of the Bauhaus, as you have seen already. So very quickly, beach intimacy. The beach was never simply the beach for the Bauhaus. It was yet another space of transgression and intimacy between teachers and students, and between teachers and sometimes also between genders, as you can see in some of those images. And finally, the love affairs. Lotte Besse, who was the, later to be the chief architect of, in charge of the massive reconstruction of bomb out Rotterdam after the war, was the first Bauhaus student to be admitted into the architecture workshop, started by Hannes Meyer in 1927. Hannes Meyer somehow convinced her that you have to associate yourself with a male architect in order to succeed. So she had an affair with him, where he was married with children. But when he became the director, Hannes Meyer basically was asked to leave the school because he wouldn't look good. So it's not Kim who has to leave, but or has to behave, but she has to leave so that the other one looks good. Walter Gropius, while still married to Alma Mahler and with a mistress, Lily Hildebrand, had a sexual relationship with a student who was a war widow. Sweatshops. After the preliminary course, all women were sent to the weaving workshop, whether they like it or not. Here you have what Gertrude Arndt said. They all went to the weaving workshop, whether they wanted or not, yet that was simply the way out. I never wanted to weave. It was absolutely not my aim, not at all, not all this dress. I didn't want that, not, that was not my thing. And you can see she's not very happy. She's she's up there with someone. And Otti Berger and another student in the workshop. But this is the interesting thing. Since weaving made the greatest profit of all for the Bauhaus, we could ask if it was really a workshop or a sweatshop. All these women were sustaining financially the Bauhaus, but they were diminished between it. It was a transgressive school in many ways, but not in gender politics. Walter Gropius even theorized this discrimination in his inaugural lecture. The artistic impulse was that of a man who has experienced the horror of war. So he writes, or he says in this lecture, the awakening of the whole man through trauma, lack, terror, hard life, experience of love, leads to the authentic artistic expression. Dearest ladies, I do not underestimate the human achievement of those who remain at home during the war, but I believe that the lived experience of death to be all powerful. Of course, many students arrive at the Bauhaus directly from military service, and Gropius himself was a casualty of war. He was injured in an abandoned for several days in a bombed-out and totally destroyed building. He later wrote, first man must be constructed. This is what the Bauhaus attempted to do, reconstruct the human. Outfits likewise reflect this military background, starting with Gropius going around in his leather jacket, but also extreme poverty led to the reconstruction of military uniforms into everyday outfits and multiple other gender-bending configurations. But the military never quite went away, and even the idea of a quasi-military uniform, including a whistle, appears in the end, as you can see in this quote of Tut Slemmer. At first, people let themselves go. Boys had long hair and girls had short skirts. No collars or stockings were worn, which was shocking and extravagant. Then a Bauhaus garment was designed. The Bauhaus whistle and the Bauhaus salute were invented. One was also cold and hungry for the sake of one's ideals. So the military, in the end, never goes away, and this uniform is established. So my final point is that it was a uniform of transgression, precisely. Thank you very much.